This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, you may have been lucky enough to observe a rare celestial occurrence, and that is the transit of Mercury across the Sun. And as Mercury sailed past the Sun, it blotted out a tiny bit of the Sun's light. You know, it's so small, it appeared like a black dot, like a period, slowly pushing its way across a great ball of light. Well, that same idea, observing a planet as it passes the face of its star, happens to be one of the key ways we detect exoplanets, too. These are planets outside our solar system. And this week, scientists from NASA's Kepler mission announced a huge new haul of planets, 1,284 exoplanets, huge, as we say today, added to our roster of known worlds beyond the solar system, which makes a total of over 3,200 planets we know of out there in the great beyond. So next time you look up in the night sky, instead of seeing just stars, you might do as my next guest does and imagine each of those stars as a solar system, a whole solar system instead. Natalie Battaglia is Kepler mission scientist at NASA Ames Research Center in California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
How exciting is this?
It's been a great week. Yeah, it's been a long time coming. We've been working on this methodology and this paper for several years. It's a methodology that's been in the works for a long time.
So it looks like there are a lot more of them out there than we ever thought or believed.
Exoplanets, you mean?
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, as we look at these discoveries that are rolling in from Kepler and we crunch the numbers, we quickly realize that every star out there has at least one exoplanet orbiting it.
And Kepler was looking at just the tiniest patch of sky.
Yeah, you hold up your hand outstretched, kind of like a police officer saying, stop. That's the size of your hand, outreached hand, is about the size of the sky that we're looking at. So it's 10 degrees by 10 degrees on the sky.
So if you were to extrapolate those results to the whole galaxy, how many planets might be out there?
Oh, we're talking billions. We're talking tens of billions. Even if I isolate the population to really the ones that we're very interested in, those that could potentially harbor life, as we know it at least, that number is in excess of 10 billion in our galaxy alone.
I'm just blown away by that number. Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it tells us that there's a lot of possibility, right?
Yeah.
And of the planets that we have found, the diversity is so great, you know, where we're finding worlds that we couldn't have imagined before. Maybe George Lucas could have, you know, he had the world Tatooine where you have the planets orbiting two stars instead of one. We've got lava worlds, you know, just an enormous diversity, planets that we don't see in our own solar system. So nature is quite grand.
I'll bet. And now is Kepler basically on a census mission trying to get a tally of all these different kinds of exoplanets?
That's right. We're taking a census of sorts. It's like calling up 1,000 people and finding out who they're voting for and extrapolating that to the larger population. We're surveying about 200,000 stars, looking at the planets that are orbiting them, at least within what we call one astronomical unit, kind of an Earth orbit and inward. And then trying to understand, based on those results, what the population of planets is in the galaxy.
These new planets we're talking about, the 1,200 new planets, they were actually spotted a while back, right?
Yeah, we saw evidence of their existence in the periodic dimmings of light that we observe. But when we see those tantalizing signals in the data, we don't jump the gun. We call them planet candidates. And the reason for that is because there are astrophysical signals in nature that can mimic these periodic dimmings of light. And so we have to do due diligence. We have to weed out all of these potential imposters in order to really say that this is a bona fide planet.
Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things in all your data of planets is that there is a real abundance of planets that seem to be between Earth and Neptune size, something that we don't really have in our solar system, do we?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So in our own solar system, we've got the small rocky worlds, what we call the terrestrial worlds, orbiting close to the sun. We've got the gas giants orbiting far away. And the leap in size between those populations is like a factor of four, right? Earth being kind of the biggest thing in the terrestrial, among the terrestrial planets at one Earth radius. Neptune would be the next. That's four times bigger than Earth. And so in between, we don't really have anything in our own solar system, or at least we don't think we do. I'll be a little mysterious there. But yet, the most common
planet... Say that again.
Well, I was alluding to the possibility of planet 9 in our own solar system. You know, looking at the gravitational perturbations of the Kuiper Belt objects, and maybe that's an indication that there's another planet out there, and maybe it fits in that, in between sizes, something in between Earth and Neptune. I don't know. Time will tell. But these kinds of planets in that size range are actually the most common planet known to humanity right now.
Huh. What planets out of this latest batch are your favorites? Which do you think might be the most interesting?
Oh, goodness. I'm intrigued by the lava worlds. I'm intrigued by the photodisintegrating planets that we see, planets that are literally breaking apart before our eyes. They're emitting these huge cometary-like tails. It might give us an opportunity to sample exactly what planets are made out of. So I'm intrigued by those. I'm intrigued by these super-Earths, or what we call sub-Neptunes, this in-between region that you talked about. I'm also very intrigued by the oldest planets that we are finding. There are planets in the Kepler catalog that are as old as the galaxy itself. And that, to me, was a very surprising result, because when you think about the building blocks that are required to construct a planet, it wasn't really obvious to me that those building blocks would be available when the galaxy was in its infancy.
Wow.
But yet, here we've got these planets, and I'm intrigued by the idea that there are planets out there that are twice the age of the Earth. And I wonder, you know, given that much time to evolve complexity and evolve life, you know, what are the possibilities?
No wonder you just can't go out and look at the sky and just look at a star anymore.
It does tend to change one's perspective. That's right.
is the ultimate goal to find life, or is it just to understand the planetary formation, as you say, the history of the galaxy and so on?
Both of those things are tremendously important, and depending on which scientist you ask, you're going to get a different answer. For me, certainly, my passion for science is driven by the search for evidence of life beyond Earth. And so NASA does have a kind of long-term vision, or roadmap, if you will, for doing exactly that. It's one of the primary, you know, science goals of NASA's astrophysics division, absolutely.
And how could you not believe it? You said there were tens of billions just in our own galaxy here.
Right.
How could you not believe that somewhere there's going to be some form of life? It's almost just like a certainty.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir. I believe that as well. If I have to use that word, believe, just as a hunch, you know, mm-hmm. it would be a terrible waste of space, of course. But the reality is we don't know, right?
I mean,
we've got these Goldilocks worlds. These are planets where there's the possibility that liquid water could pool on the surface. But that doesn't tell you what fraction of those are truly habitable environments where there is liquid water and where life could flourish. Mm-hmm. My impression is that microbial life is going to be ubiquitous on these worlds, whether or not there's additional complexity or intelligent life. I don't know. Maybe that is even yet rarer still. But time will tell. We have to do this systematic methodical search in order to answer that question.
Will the upcoming James Webb telescope help us get a closer look at any of these?
The James Webb Space Telescope is going to look at exoplanets, absolutely. It's going to do something called transmission spectroscopy. James Webb, we want to feed James Webb some of these transiting planets that we have found. They're very special for the following reason. when you have a planet transiting across the disk of its star, some of the starlight is going to filter through the atmosphere of that planet. And in doing so, the atmosphere is going to leave a chemical fingerprint on the light that's streaming through. And so the James Webb Space Telescope will be able to catch that light, spread it out into a spectrum, and see those chemical fingerprints. And that's going to tell us what those atmospheres are made out of.
Wow.
Now, the big question is, can it do that for potentially habitable Earth-sized planets? And there I'm kind of skeptical. I think James Webb is going to be really great at characterizing the atmospheres of the Neptunes, the sub-Neptunes, and if we get lucky, maybe a smaller planet like Earth. But I think that remains to be seen. We'd have to get really lucky.
A couple of listeners' questions. One tweet from Patrick Fire says, can your guest speak a little on how you determine the age of an exoplanet or the composition of it?
Yeah, great question. We can do that by looking at the star itself. So we have a lot of information about the star. In some of these situations, we have what's called asteroseismic information. We can see in the brightness measurements, we can see pulsations of the light that's coming from the star. Those pulsations are star quakes that are causing the light to vary at very high frequencies. And by analyzing those star quakes, you can actually get the fundamental properties of the star itself. And one of those fundamental properties is the age.
Well, there you have it. We want to wish you the best of luck in doing this, Dr. Battaglia.
Thank you so much.
And the Kepler spacecraft itself, is it in good shape, or is it having a problem?
It's doing fantastic.
Okay.
It was hobbling along for a little while. It had a hiccup. It lost a reaction wheel. The engineers resuscitated it, and it's been operating ever since. It's taking data. It has enough fuel on board to last until about mid-2018, I think, is the current projection.
All right.
So it's doing some great science.
Natalie Battaglia is Kepler mission scientist at NASA Ames Research Center in California. Coming up, after a break, a math hero gets the big screen treatment. We'll talk about the real man behind the movie, The Man Who Knew Infinity. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In 1913, the British number theorist G.H. Hardy received a strange letter with his morning tea. It came from faraway Madras, India. The sender was a poor Hindu clerk, a two-time college dropout named Srinivasa Ramanujan. The letter contained mathematical formulas so fantastical, so strange, Hardy would later say that they had to be true. No one would have the imagination to invent them. Among mathematicians, that long ago correspondent, Ramanujan, holds mystic status. Among us lay people, not so much. Well, a new movie is trying to change that. The Man Who Knew Infinity tells the story of this outsider mathematician who died at just 32 years of age. In his short life, Ramanujan filled three notebooks with strange, enigmatic formulas that continue to boggle the minds of mathematicians, mathematicians like my next guest. Ken Ono is the Asa Griggs Candler Professor of Math and Computer Science at Emory University and consultant on the movie The Man Who Knew Infinity. He's also the author of a new memoir co-written with the late Amir Ikzel, My Search for Ramanujan. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Ono.
Good afternoon, Ira. Glad to be here.
It's a great story, a great book. The film is, I saw a little bit of it. Let's start first with how you first heard about Ramanujan. This story also involves a letter, right?
Oh, boy. Actually, Ramanujan for me seems to be nothing but letters. I first learned about Ramanujan when I was a reticent teenager. I was 16 in 1984. I was about to drop out of high school myself, and a letter came to the house. It was April 7th, 1984. I'll never forget it. And it was a letter written to my father from Janaki Amal, a woman in her 80s who lived in Madras, who turned out to be the widow of an Indian genius, Ramanujan, who had died 64 years earlier.
Wow, you've called Ramanujan math's greatest anticipator. What do you mean by that?
Well, so as you mentioned a moment ago, Ramanujan died very young, at the age of 32. And what he did in his notebooks is he wrote down formulas which for him were flights of fancy, only for us to find that as mathematicians of his future, that he wrote down formulas and functions that we've ended up needing. People have won Fields medals for making use of his functions. Fermat's last theorem probably would not have been proven had Ramanujan never lived. His legacy goes so far beyond the questions that people were even asking when he was alive.
And these ideas were not around when he was alive,
right.
Is what you're saying.
Right. We're using his formulas to study black holes today. People didn't even know black holes existed in 1913.
Mm-hmm. Ramanujan got into math because of one book, right?
That's right.
An old math tutoring book.
Right. Ramanujan got, it's not a very good book, honestly. It's called A Synopsis of Mathematics by a British tutor like G.S. Carr. And what it is a list of 6,000 theorems and formulas laid out systematically, but with almost no text in between. It was something like an almanac of mathematical formulas. And somehow this incomplete list of formulas ignited his passion.
And he dropped out of college.
Twice.
Because of the book.
That's right. Because of this book, he felt that the mathematics in the book were laid out like puzzles to him, and he needed to finish them and then find formulas of his own. And kind of like a college kid might be addicted to video games, Ramanujan became addicted to finding his own formulas, and as a result was a very poor student. He didn't do his homework, didn't attend class, and well, it didn't end up very well for him in school, at least.
Yeah. And then Ramanujan writes to the British mathematician G.H. Hardy with some of his formulas. And here's Jeremy Irons as Hardy in the movie, opening Ramanujan's letter in the film The Man Who Knew Infinity.
I beg to introduce myself as a clerk in the accounts department.
What this time?
Quite impressive, really. Someone's gone to a lot of trouble. A Hindu clerk, and who claims he can give meaning to the negative values of the gamma function.
Well, without getting into the gamma function, what was in the letter that convinced Hardy that Ramanujan was the real deal here?
Well, it's a fantastic letter for several reasons. First of all, Ramanujan writes in a very humble way. He begins with the words, "I beg to introduce myself as a clerk in the accounts department. I've had no university education." But what followed were 7 pages of mathematical scrawl, almost with no words. One of the claims is that if you add up the positive integers, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4, and never stop, well, we all know that that goes to infinity. You can't add up all the positive numbers and get anything other than infinity. But Ramanujan claims, well, not only don't you get infinity, you get a negative number. You get negative 1/12. That seems crazy. But to Hardy would have understood that that was actually a brilliant observation. The letter also had some other mistakes. But amazingly, the letter ended on the 9th page with 3 formulas. 3 formulas that were so startling that Hardy said nobody could have the imagination to invent these formulas. And you know what's true about those 3 formulas? We didn't figure them out until about 4 years ago.
Wow.
So that's how crazy some of the formulas happened to be in his writings.
Now, let me play another clip from The Man Who Knew Infinity. And this is Harvey, played again by Jeremy Irons, talking to a Ramanujan, played by Dev Patel.
Listen, I'm hard on you for your own benefit, so that you can be published.
But, sir, you can publish the notebooks and my prime number theorem. You've had them since I arrived.
There's nothing I'd like more, but if I was to publish them in their present state, I'd be sent to the lunatic asylum.
You don't understand these. I don't think about this the same way you do. These steps you want, what you want, I do not know how to do.
Well, you can just begin by trying your best and see if you don't surprise yourself.
So he was not a mathematician in the classical sense.
Oh, no.
A professional mathematician.
Right. Well, try to remember the time period. This is around 1913, 1914, and India was subjugated by England. And it was quite extraordinary for Hardy to invite an Indian to be a distinguished scholar at Cambridge, and in particular, one with no university education whatsoever. So Ramanujan, when he was recording his formulas in a notebook, he was he might as well have been living in a desert. Mm. Nobody understood him. He didn't know how you did mathematics. But somehow, in the areas of math that he worked in, he was able to basically eclipse the accumulated wisdom of Western Europe, and that was astonishing. Whereas Hardy, your image of this distinguished Cambridge professor about you have to go through these courses, you have to earn the right to prove theorems, and there's an actual procedure that one has to follow for when writing up papers. These two men couldn't have been more different in yeah. how they did math from different countries. And never mind that Ramanujan was a devout Hindu who said that his ideas came to him as visions from a goddess, where Hardy is an atheist. Everything about these two men should have meant that they would have been unable to understand each other. And that's one of the beautiful things about this film. It's about how two very different people with the same passion can somehow forge an incredible relationship, no matter, independent of the fact that it was very short. And it's a beautiful film because of that.
And why was Hardy different than everyone else? Why did he accept Patel?
Ramanujan.
Right. Calling the actor, right?
So yeah. I write about this actually in my book, among other things. I think Hardy perhaps was the only man alive who would have been able to, at that time, to recognize Ramanujan's genius. The skill that Ramanujan exhibited in his letters, even if you were to show those letters today to professional mathematicians, maybe only 1 in 100 would see the beauty and importance of the work. What did Hardy know? Hardy was at the time, probably the world's leading analytic number theorist. So he had spent some time thinking about these kinds of objects. And some of the claims Hardy knew and others were so foreign that, well, he felt that he needed to get to the bottom of all that.
So he was visualizing all this stuff in his head. And he never wrote down, and that's what upset the status quo mathematicians. He didn't write the proofs down of
right.
how he knew what he knew.
Well, even to this day, it has to be said that paper was very expensive in India. So to have 3 notebooks was a luxury for Ramanujan. Mm. So he did most of his work on this little slate, and his calculations would end up with some sort of result. And all he did was record the result in the notebooks. So there is that component, too. It's not just that he didn't know how to write down proofs. He just didn't have space in his notebooks to record his steps.
Well, when you look at his notebooks, does the math look different from other math?
It does. If you happen to see a poster for the film, you can see some of the reproductions of Ramanujan's work, and it's beautiful. There are no words. His handwriting, his script it's gorgeous, but it's very difficult to figure out what he meant. So, for example, halfway through the first notebook, you'll find that he writes out the first 30 digits of pi. Why would it take Ramanujan half a notebook to get to the first 30 digits of pi? And it turns out that nothing on that page around it seems to have anything to do with pi. It's all a mystery.
Yeah. You learned about Ramanujan from your dad when you were 16, right?
Not long
after you drop out of high school, too.
About that time. So when the letter came to my house, I'd never heard of Ramanujan before. And the letter thanked my father for making a small gift to help pay for a bust of Ramanujan. And my father, who was a very stoic man, was a very emotional moment for him. You see, when Ramanujan died in 1920, his widow was promised a statue. The government promised to erect a statue in Ramanujan's honor, and they never came through. And by the early 1980s, the mathematicians of the world got wind of this, and they had a fundraising campaign, and my father was one of many who made a contribution. So the letter, presumably Janaki Amal sent hundreds of them, was just a form letter, really. But it was an opportunity for my father to tell me about this legendary man I'd never heard of before. And to tell you the truth, that was the beginning of the healing between the two of us. Because at the time, the reason I was about to quit high school is that I felt like I was being suffocated under parental expectations. I was supposed to be the straight-A student, supposed to get perfect test scores. And, that's not what I was about at that time. And I needed a hero. I needed someone who could inspire me that said that, well, there's a lot more to test scores and grades. There's a lot to creativity and actually producing content. And it was important for me to hear that from my father and my parents when, you know, honestly, they were a large source of the parental expectations that right. I was struggling with.
Talking with Ken Ono, who is professor of math and computer science at Emory University, his memoir is called My Search for Ramanujan on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So that's quite interesting. He was a bridge for you, too, I mean, in your youth.
Several times. In fact, this is why Amir, regrettably, he passed away. It would have been wonderful if he could be here with us today.
Yeah.
Ramanujan helped me as a teenager recognize that my parents looked up to someone like Ramanujan, who was a two-time college dropout. And later in college, I had a great professor, Paul Sally, at the University of Chicago, who helped rescue me as a senior. And he helped me get into graduate school.
Right.
And that was shortly after the Nova special about Ramanujan aired. And then lastly, as a graduate student, my advisor, who really turned me on to mathematics. There's a difference between being good at mathematics and then being passionate about the subject. Professor Gordon helped me find that passion. And one of the first steps along the way was reading the biography, The Man Who Knew Infinity, which came out when I was in graduate school, and that's the book that the film is based on,
and you're the advisor,
and I have to say I'm an accidental associate producer. It's been I'll be sorry to see the theatrical end run because it's been two wonderful years.
It's hard making a movie, isn't it?
It's unbelievable how many moving parts there are.
Yeah, done a little of that. How would you rate? Where does Ramanujan stand on all of mathematicians? I mean, he died at 32.
He died at 32, right? So I actually write a chapter about this at the end of my book in the epilogue, and it's very difficult to rank mathematicians. It's hard to rank anything.
Yeah.
How do you rank colleges? How do
right.
you rank basketball players? So. There are many different kinds of mathematicians. You could be a theory builder. You could be someone who's whip smart, able to solve problems much more quickly than anyone else. Or you could be someone who can borrow ideas from one area of science and apply them in another. These are all ways in which you can be world class. But in Ramanujan, we have something completely different. We have an incomplete prophet. He died young. He left behind three notebooks that we've been mining 100 years after his death. And just think about it. We have been studying his notebooks for 100 years, and we are still learning about the full potential of his ideas. So as an anticipator of the future, as someone whose ideas mean a lot for the future of science, I'm not sure Ramanujan has an equal.
Well, you hope now that the biopic about Ramanujan, The Man Who Knew Infinity, which is in theaters now, you hope this will create some sort of buzz.
Oh, absolutely.
Because ask anybody who's not in the field of mathematics, they've never heard of it.
That's right. Well, I'm delighted to say that today is the opening day for the wide release of The Man Who Knew Infinity. So if you're listening to me now, please go and see the film tonight. We think that Ramanujan should be a household name. Think Isaac Newton to England. Why does Ramanujan matter? Well, we've talked about the science. Of course, to mathematicians like me, he matters. But what he symbolizes is much greater. What he symbolizes is that greatness can be found in the most unforgiving of circumstances. And it's the responsibility of teachers and mentors alike to first recognize that talent and then find a way to nurture it. Why is this super important today, and in particular for this show? So science usually proceeds by the work of thousands, slowly adding to a body of work.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've said just a moment ago, every once in a while, some people come along and they propel knowledge further. They're rare. And that's what we have in Ramanujan.
Right. We can go on talking with the Ken Ono forever. He also has a memoir called My Search for Ramanujan. And as he says, the film opens today, The Man Who Knew Infinity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ira.
For taking time to be with us today. We're going to come back when we talk about the Science Club. It's going to come to order and find out what you guys found out there. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. That sound means, of course, it's time for our Science Club to meet and kick off this season's project and looking at scientific sampling. Yeah, we told you to go out and sample stuff, anything you wanted to sample. You had a month to explore your world, and now we're back to talk about what you found. Did you take a sample to answer some question about the world around you? Did you? Give us a call. We want to hear about it. Our number, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, the phone number, 844-SciTalk. And here to get us going to talk about some of the projects you sent in, our Science Club founding members, Ariel Zitch and Charles Berquist. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ira.
Hey, thanks, Ira.
Ariel's joining us from WESA in Pittsburgh. And also joining the Science Club today is Ryan Singleton. He's an associate professor of biology and environmental science at Franklin Pierce University in New Hampshire, where, among other things, he teaches budding ecologists how to do field work. And he's at New Hampshire Public Radio today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, Charles, kick us off on the Science Club. Remind us what people had to do.
Well, we started by saying a lot of the really interesting questions in the world, like how many hairs are there on my dog? They're things that would really be hard to answer in a straightforward manner. You can't count all the hairs on your dog. So we wanted people to think first of a question about their world that they were interested in exploring, something that might be hard to get a handle on in a straightforward linear fashion, and then work out a way to use sampling to explore a little bit of that thing and use that little bit to answer the larger question, or at least approximate the larger question.
Yeah, draw a conclusion about the larger And Ariel, how well did we do for projects coming in?
Oh, my goodness. There were just so many interesting things. Well, so first off, the questions were all over the map. So Ms. Nolan's fourth grade class wanted to know what was in their schoolyard. And so they actually sampled their schoolyard by the square meter and then extrapolated to the whole schoolyard to estimate they had, like, you know, 4,000 caterpillars, which is cool. And then Doug and coworkers were really excited when they found a giant bag of cookies in the vending machine. And so they decided to spend the month sampling the bags of cookies to see if all of the cookies.
Tough assignment.
Yeah, right. I know. Eating cookies every week to kind of get an estimate of the number of cookies per bag. So we did very, very well.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your favorites? You mentioned them, but there was some sort of really interesting. There's one about dog poop, I understand.
Yeah, we had a couple of dog poop heroes. Shout out to Claudia and Teresa for attacking one of my least favorite things about living in an urban environment. They had a dog park that was overrun with dog poop, and they wanted to know, okay, what is the actual daily rate of dog poop leavage? And so they actually cleaned up and counted the number of poops left every day for a whole week in their dog park, and then also counted got an estimate for the other dog parks in the area to estimate that in an average year, about 32,000 dog poops go uncleaned in their neighborhood, which is a pretty telling sample estimate. I know. I thought that was incredible.
You should get that in the newspaper.
Yeah, right. I know. I think that could inspire some change. There were also some of those questions that were just kind of quirky and curious. So Lily wanted to know what like a tolerable number of R2-D2 sounds were. So she actually watched some of the Star Wars series and sampled the number of R2-D2 sounds that he makes in a typical Star Wars film, and then tried to figure out kind of what is like the going R2-D2 speech rate, and it's about 54.66 sounds per video or per movie, which I thought was kind of interesting. We also had a ton of citizen science projects. So folks that have been doing citizen science, like Craig, who's been sampling the Charles River for over 20 years, like Laura and her family, who went out with Save Our Streams and sampled aquatic microinvertebrates and macroinvertebrates to figure out if their stream was healthy, which it was. It got a clean bill of health thanks to all of the stoneflies and caddisflies they found. And we also had a lot of scientists who were just doing their thing. Scientists use sampling all the time, and a lot of them were courteous enough to share some of their scientific sampling with us, mm-hmm. which is really excellent.
Speaking of scientists, Ryan Singleton, you saw some of the questions our listeners were tackling, and you teach early ecology students field techniques. What are some of the key rules that you need to go out, if you're sampling, going out into the field? What are the rules of thumb here?
Yeah, well, we could boil it down to three, which I think give a pretty good start, and maybe I'll just list them, and then we could talk about each one in a bit more detail if you want. But I would say the first thing is to define the population you plan to sample from. And the hair on a dog would be a great example. Nobody's ever going to count all those hairs, but you could define that population and take a subsample. The second rule of thumb is to take care to get an unbiased representative sample. Really key, and I think we could talk a little bit more about that in a second if you want. And then my third rule of thumb would be to keep in mind the sampling effort that it's going to require to do your study. And I think a lot of your listeners did a wonderful job. I had a lot of fun browsing your webpage with those posts.
Our number, 844-724-8255. We have some calls coming in from people who did some sampling. Let's go to Orlando. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Ira. How are we doing?
Fine. Go ahead.
I'm a appliance repairman here in Orlando, and actually I took a sample over maybe like the last year or so of my career, and literally every person's dryer smells the same. It, no matter what kind of like dryer lint you have, no matter what kind of dryer sheets you use, any kind of product, I've worked in thousands of homes, and every single dryer smells exactly the same.
That's a big sample, Kevin. Have you told Maytag about this? Maybe they know.
No, not yet. I'm pretty sure they'd know, though.
All right. That's truly unique. Thanks, Kevin, for calling. Wow. Ryan, what do you think about that?
I do have a response. That seems to violate one of the fundamental rules of the natural world. I'm constantly telling my students that there's variability everywhere you look, and apparently I hadn't yet looked in dryers, so I guess we have an exception to that rule now.
Charles, how well did our listeners do on these things? We heard from Ariel talking about some of the school kids.
Right. I mean, there was a lot of creativity out there, and the approaches to the questions were really, really amazing. Probably, I think if we look back to Ryan's three rules, the one that people had most trouble with was the representative sample, the unbiased sample. I think some of our submissions, while they were really great, definitely had concerns with sample size and right. whether or not they were truly picking a representative sample of the population. It's hard to say something about the entire universe of carrots when you measure 5 carrots.
Oh. Well, Ryan, how many carrots would you need to...
Well, we got to define what population of carrots we're interested in, and I'm pretty sure there's several varieties out there. So
how do you know when your sample size is big enough, right?
That's a great question, and statisticians love to debate that. There's this thing called a power analysis that you can do in statistics that, in part, depends on how big a difference you're trying to detect. So that is hard to boil down to a rule of thumb, but there's a lot of fun math you can do to try to calculate what your ideal sample size should be.
Mm-hmm. Ariel, during the course of the project, you ran a few Twitter polls as demonstrations, right?
Yes, we did. So we figured, okay, like what better environment to get a giant sample size than in the Twitter sphere, right? So put it out to our, like, you know, all of our followers, some 600,000 people, and asked them if they could curl their tongue, and wanted to see, like, what, you know, rate of response we got, and also what the, like, rate of tongue curlage is among our audience. This used to be thought of as a heritable Mendelian trait. No more. We know now that it can be learned, and it's plastic and probably controlled by a lot of stuff. But we got this response rate of, like, 2,000, 3,000 people, and 81% of them could curl their tongue. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. Let's share our results, right? But I asked around to some friendly statisticians who hang out with Twitter as a collection tool, and they said, no, like, this is actually a crazy opportunity to evaluate whether your poll is biased. And in fact, our poll was really biased because people are more likely to respond if they can curl their tongue. People might try to learn how to curl their tongue before responding. People might be embarrassed if they can't. We also realized pretty quickly that, yeah, Science Friday listeners, you're exceptional guys. Like, we know that. We know that they're, like, scientific minds, right? They're not an unbiased sample in and of themselves. So we can't even infer a whole lot about, like, American tongue curling rates based on our sample, because Science Friday followers are a special breed of Twitter followers.
Wow. That's good news and bad news.
It is. Yeah. We did get some pictures, also some questions about what constituted a tongue curl. So there's a lot of things that you can do to poll with Twitter more effectively. But, sampling it's not easy, actually. It can be pretty challenging.
Ryan, there's a lesson right there.
There is a lesson, and I loved that example. I got a real kick out of it. But I thought to myself, well, okay, what if we define the population as the Twitter followers of Science Friday? Mm. Then we'd, perhaps want to know the answer to the question, but the self-reporting bias is a challenge. It's a little different than the challenges I experience. Sometimes I find myself with students in a shrubby thicket, and we've got to get an unbiased representative sample. And it's very tempting to go towards that slight clearing in the thicket so you don't get your eye or your ear poked with those sharp undergrowth. But we got to dive right into the thicket on our hands and knees and get that representative sample. So my challenges are a little different than the self-reporting bias that you guys experienced, but I could really sympathize.
When you say one of your three rules is keep in mind sampling effort, what did you mean by that?
Well, that's the biggest category. So that's kind of a grab bag to boil this down to three. But on a basic level, it's how much time is it going to take you to get enough meaningful information to proceed with the study? And if you're just doing something for fun, measuring one or two individuals could be pretty cool and rewarding, but it may not be very meaningful. I experience this kind of problem with my students when they want to study the bear or the moose or the coyotes or bobcat that come through our campus. And they quickly realize it's going to take many, many hours to possibly even find sign of one of those, although it is possible. So to design a study that's doable, you've got to keep in mind constraints. How much time do you have? How much funding might it take? Those kinds of things. And then if you're comparing different areas, you may need equal sampling effort in different areas that you're comparing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot there.
I'll bet. We're talking about our sampling project on our Science Club this hour on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Here with Ariel Zitch and also with Charles Berquist and Ryan Singleton. Ariel, who ended up participating in this? Who contributed? All sorts of people?
Pretty much every kind of sampler you could imagine. I mean, we didn't have any animal samplers, but we did have many people who sampled things about animals. We had a whole bunch of people from, like I mentioned, the scientific field. We had a bunch of normal humans who are just interested in coin collecting, who are interested in water. We had a bunch of schools participate, including a school from South Korea, which was incredible. You want to talk about sampling effort? They were sampling things like how many grains of sand might there be on a beach and estimating it.
Whoa.
So, like, they took on some pretty serious mathematical challenges, not to mention ones that required an extraordinary amount of patience. It was really the whole gamut.
Yeah, I want to give a special shout out to Mrs. Reed's class at Donner Trail Elementary in Truckee, California.
We're from Donner Trail School. We sample the haunted cutthroat trout.
And how many do you have?
100.
Is that all of the Lahontan cutthroat trout?
No.
No, what do you have?
A sample.
A sample of them, yeah.
So they're kindergarten,
wow.
Yeah, kindergartners through fifth grade, did a study with the Headwaters Science Institute, which is an educational outreach environmental group out there, and they looked at 150 of these cutthroat trout, and so we thank them for their efforts.
You know, you don't realize how much of an influence on kids something like that may have, Ariel, do you? I mean, just going out and something they'll remember for the rest of their lives and understand a little bit more about how science works.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, and for me, what was so, like, mind-opening, and I think was, like, mind-opening for the people who participated in this project is that, like, you really can glimpse the unfathomable. This is, like, how humans understand things, right? We know that we like vanilla ice cream because we've sampled it a whole bunch, and we generally like vanilla ice cream, right? Like, it's something that is so human to do, and yet when you take it to that scientific level and you start, like, stepping a little further out, you can explore incredible things, like whole mountainsides or whole yeah. ecosystems. So it's a lot of fun. We really had a great time.
Well, are we cooking up another project? Are we just thinking about it now, Charles?
We're thinking about it. We'll be back in the fall with something fun for people to try, so definitely stay tuned for that.
Ryan, any suggestions about projects that you...
Oh, gosh. Well, it's an amazing world out there. I say go out and sample. Continue sampling. One of the beautiful things is when you get out there and sample, you tend to notice things that you never would have noticed otherwise. So I encourage everybody to do that.
All right. And Ariel, we'll be putting our thinking caps on for the next project.
Please do. And if you've got good ideas that you want to share with us, you can share them at scienceclub@sciencefriday.com. You can email us and check out the website. So there's so many great samples out there that you guys can see at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub.
There you have it for this Science Club edition. Science Sci-Fi Education Manager Ariel Zitch, contributing producer Charles Berquist of the Science Club, Ryan Singleton, Associate Professor of Biology and Environmental Science at Franklin Pierce University in New Hampshire. Thank you all.
Thank you. Have a
great weekend. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And on the web this week, remember when you bought your first Kindle and how cool it was to read an e-book that looked like paper? Well, the guys who invented that display called electronic ink were just inducted into the Inventors Hall of Fame. Yeah, they should have been, right? And you can read the whole story about the ink and the Kindle and the Hall of Fame at a link at sciencefriday.com/ink. That's about all the time we have for this week. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.